Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Even with the reimbursements, it's going to be very hard for families to find the ATVs and snow machines and outboard motors.
State and federal officials visit Nome to plan storm recovery efforts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Hooper Bay reckons with the storm's emotional toll and the village's future.
After seeing that storm, it's like, what's next?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
An Anchorage woman died yesterday after the float plane she was flying crashed into a lake near Squintna. Investigators say 2 dogs were also killed in the crash. The body of 67-year-old Janelle Rood, the only person on board, was recovered from Whiskey Lake by military rescue swimmers. That's according to Alaska State Troopers, who first received a report of the downed plane at about 4 p.m. Sunday. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating what caused the Cessna 180A's crash. Heidi Kemner was traveling to the lake today to inspect the wreckage.
It's in the water right now. It's overturned. And so we're going to work on getting it either recovered so that we can look at it and kind of make a plan for that end and proceed with the investigation that way.
Kemner said weather over the lake was reportedly good, with clouds at 8,000 to 11,000 feet. The state medical examiner's office will perform an autopsy on Rood's body. A Coast Guard crew encountered a Chinese guided missile cruiser in the Bering Sea last week. The Coast Guard cutter Kimball was on a routine patrol when the vessel encountered the cruiser about 75 miles north of Kiska Island in the western Aleutians. That's according to a statement released by the U.S. Coast Guard this morning. The statement says the Coast Guard crew identified 2 more Chinese naval vessels and 4 Russian naval vessels, including a Russian Federation Navy destroyer. The ships were lined up together in some kind of a group formation with the Chinese cruiser. The statement did not specify what kind of exercise they might be involved in, but they were identified within the U.S. Exclusive Economic Zone. That's an area up to 200 nautical miles offshore where the U.S. has jurisdiction over natural resources. The Coast Guard crew witnessed the group of vessels disperse. The Coast Guard commander says that the foreign formation was not breaking any international rules or norms. Still, the Coast Guard says the Kimball's presence is meant to prevent any possible disruptions of U.S. interests in the area around Alaska. President Joe Biden has approved Governor Mike Dunleavy's request for a federal disaster declaration in response to the historic storm that devastated many western Alaska coastal communities a little over a week ago. That makes federal funding available to Alaskans impacted by the storm, as well as money available to state, tribal, and eligible local governments, plus some nonprofits. While there have been no reports of storm-related injury or death, the wreckage spans about 1,000 miles of Alaska coastline. It ranges from road damage in Nome to the loss of Shaktulik's berm against the sea. In Chivak, a power outage and the loss of many local boats has destroyed both frozen subsistence foods and the means to replace them. Now, government officials are assessing the damage and their priorities for recovery. KNOM's Davis Hovey spoke with Representative Mary Peltola, Senator Lisa Murkowski, and FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell in Nome.
To cap off her visit to Western Alaska, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell was able to meet with Nome residents on Saturday and hear directly from them about storm damage and their needs. She told KNOM that FEMA will support debris removal and emergency repairs over the next 3 to 5 weeks before winter hits the region.
it really was eye-opening to really realize that as we're flying over these communities and being able to truly see how one exposed they are to the elements and the storm that came in, and then just the extreme difficulty that it's going to bring to try to provide the needed support that's going to have to happen quickly over the next few weeks, but then in the long term.
Representative Mary Peltola says she was very happy to be in the Nome area and to meet with locals directly. Although her time in the Bering Strait region was brief, Peltola knows from experience that rebuilding subsistence camps, replacing gear, and shipping up materials will be challenging.
I've been trying to get an outboard motor for 2 years. Even with the reimbursements, it's going to be very hard for families to find the ATVs and snow machines and outboard motors and skiffs that they need. These are all in high demand, and we've got logistics issues. So it's really incumbent upon all of us to do what we can on our end to make it as painless for residents as we can.
During the federal officials' visit to Nome, FEMA opened up its disaster assistance portal to Alaskans affected by the recent storm. Funding is now available to local, state, and tribal governments in the damaged areas of Western Alaska. The director of Alaska's Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Brian Fisher, says their online assistance application, which mirrors FEMA's, opened Monday morning. He says the state's number one priority is getting Western Alaskans back into safe, secure, and warm homes.
Our priority with respect to the individuals and families that live out there is to remove that contaminated insulation and replace belly board, replace tin that might have been lost on folks' roofs, so replace Toyo stoves if they were damaged and flooded, upright fuel tanks. Our program does allow to provide financial aid to refill those fuel tanks, home heating oil tanks, if they were lost or spilled in the disaster.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was on the ground in Golovin and Elam last week, where she saw asphalt roads peeled back, houses moved hundreds of feet, and all kinds of storm impacts like significantly exposed permafrost. She says she wants to remove the cost share stipulation from the federal disaster funding issued by the president.
I think our push needs to be to ask for additional relief by way of assistance with the cost share waiver. I noted that the president had provided for 100% of cost reimbursement for 30 days to help with, I believe, debris removal.
Beyond those 30 days, FEMA Administrator Criswell says her agency is prioritizing a plan to provide assistance to individuals and to rebuild infrastructure in Western Alaska for the long term. But she also wants to be better prepared for future storms. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Hovey.
It's the middle of moose hunting season on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and a handful of Chivac residents were recently preparing to head out for a weekend hunt, just as they would in any other year. What's different is they're taking friends and family whose boats were destroyed by the powerful remnants of Typhoon Murbach. As Emily Schwing reports for Alaska Public Media, the village of nearly 1,000 is trying to get back to normal after the storm.
A walk around Chivac reveals a few signs that one of the most powerful storms in Alaska's history wreaked havoc here just a week ago. Up on a hill on one end of town, there's a small orange house with a loose metal roofing panel that flaps in the wind. Down the hill, brothers David and Mark Olron are also on a roof. Hurricane force winds during the storm ripped two-thirds of one side of the roof clean off David's house.
Can you guys tell me what you're doing?
From atop his house, David Olron explains how they're using sealant to patch small holes where the wind pulled out screws that held down the metal roofing.
So that's what's making it drip when it rains right now. We're trying to patch it up so it wouldn't have.
During a community meeting earlier in the week, Chivac residents were adamant. They told members of the tribal and city councils that better emergency planning should be a long-term priority. In the near term, though, storm damage assessment is the main focus. Scott Olron was hired by the tribal council, along with his friend Reggie Tuluk, to help assess storm damage.
Okay, tomorrow morning, me and Reggie are going to go to Uphun, where there's a significant amount of fish campers, to go survey their smokehouse, their fish rack, or their wall tent cabin.
It's still unclear how fishing and hunting camps may have fared in the storm, but local residents hope to have a better sense of what happened to their subsistence camps in coming days. In Chivac, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Delta Junction's city council election is the most competitive in decades.
You've got the ones that want to keep Delta the same, the way it's always been. And then there's the others that say, hey, there's no way we can support ourselves here.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
In Hooper Bay, one of the villages hit hardest by the remnants of Typhoon Murbach, school is back in session and cleanup has begun. The immediate aftermath of the flood has begun to pass, but residents of the 1,300-person village are just beginning to reckon with the emotional toll of the storm and what it means for their future. KYUK's Will McCarthy reports.
At the boat ramp on the Pahiak Slough, John Rivers is checking on the damage to his boat. It's one of the many vessels that was ripped from its anchor by a storm unlike anything Western Alaska has ever seen. But Rivers, in some ways, wasn't surprised. His grandfather told him many years ago that this storm would come.
The elder told us long ago, this would happen, the storm, if you're alive to see it. Oh yeah, I didn't see it, Grandpa. After seeing that storm, it's like, what's next?
That's the question that's on everybody's mind as Hooper Bay charts its recovery. For many in the village, the storm was traumatizing. Waters rose faster and higher than anyone thought possible. Power outages threatened subsistence food stored for the winter. Here's Loretta Smith, who lost her home in the storm.
I've lived through storms before, but this was the worst. The water came up so fast and it was so high and the waves, they were violent.
Although many of the most immediate crises posed by the storm, such as access to electricity and shelter, have been addressed, residents of the village are still coming to terms with the raw emotions of what they experienced.
I was afraid for my son and my grandma too. How will we rescue them if the water comes up? How will we save them?
This emotional toll ultimately may be the most long-lasting damage inflicted on Hooper Bay by the storm. Although the debris can be cleared and homes rebuilt, for many, a sense of security has been shattered. Families were fleeing buildings on the verge of being flooded, carrying their loved ones on their backs. The village was split into two by the rising waters, which turned parts of the town into literal islands in the storm. If they couldn't help each other, who would come in time to help the people of Hooper Bay? Emma Smith, who now works for the tribal council, said she spent most of her life in Hooper Bay. Because of the storm, she's now considering leaving.
Yeah, I don't know how to swim. I don't have a boat. I'm a single parent, single grandma taking care of kids. People were not there when I was traumatized. People were not there when my roof blew away. We had to run away ourselves. Will they be there now if it happens again? I don't know.
Mary Hoschler, another lifelong resident of the village, thinks it's time the town began to consider relocating.
Usually the water never reaches up to this thing right here.
One of her main concerns is that the boardwalk, which could take people to higher ground in the event of an even stronger flood, was washed out by the storm. Even if it's rebuilt, Hoschler says there's no guarantee it won't wash out next time too. With the boardwalk gone, there would be no way to reach higher ground.
Because on both sides of Hooper Bay, there's two sloughs. So then we're literally surrounded by water. If we do get the high waters again and we're just little islands, how are we going to get to higher grounds? 80, 90, 100 miles an hour winds and no planes cannot come.
Hoschler also fears future floods will only become worse, in part because many of the rows of dunes that protected the village from storm surges were completely washed away by this storm. The next time a flood comes, there'll be one less barrier to stop the water. Meanwhile, experts say these types of storms are becoming increasingly common as our oceans warm due to climate change. Taken together, lifelong residents like Hochler and Smith feel like the storm calls Hooper Bay's entire existence into question. Here's Emma Smith again, the resident who's considering leaving town.
I know worry wouldn't solve any problems, but it's hard not to worry after seeing and experiencing what we went through with that storm.
John Rivers buys boat at the slough, says he too is fearful for the future. He lived to see his grandfather's prediction come true, but he doesn't know what will come next.
He tried to make us understand the world is about to end, but the worst are yet to come. I don't know yet.
Reporting from Hooper Bay, I'm Will McCarthy.
The ink is dry on the purchase of an old Anchorage hotel that's been converted into a workforce housing complex. With more than 130 rooms available, the aim of the guest house building in downtown is to help homeless people transition into more permanent housing. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
The guest house purchase is part of a large, multi-tiered approach to addressing homelessness and housing shortages in Anchorage. The plan was put forward through a partnership between public and private entities, as well as Mayor Dave Bronson's administration and the Assembly. While the facilitated negotiation process fell through in June, parts of the plan are coming together. The guest house was bought for $7.8 million by First Presbyterian Church, LLC. Part of the funds come from the Assembly, which approved a grant of $3.4 million, and the rest came from private partners, largely the Rasmussen Foundation. Reverend Matt Schultz of First Presbyterian says, though the nonprofit is related to the church operates separately and isn't receiving any of that money.
The funds come from elsewhere, and they go elsewhere. And eventually, someday down the road, we will hand off the leadership of this project to another entity. And at that point, we will have made a profit of $0.
First Presbyterian owns the building, but day-to-day operations are handled by MASH LLC, a homeless services nonprofit headed by former U.S. Senator Mark Begich. All of the residents have recently been homeless and either have a job or are in the process of getting employed. Unlike homeless shelters, Schultz says the guest house is a housing complex, operating just like a typical renter-landlord system.
Each resident gets a room, they pay rent on it, they have that ownership, and they know that it's theirs. They can lock the door when they go to work in the morning, come home to their safe and cared for possessions and home.
The guest house operates differently than some housing and sheltering options in that it's low barrier. Schultz says that means tenants don't need to meet certain requirements, like being sober, for example, in order to get housing.
The lowered barrier is really in terms of security deposit, which is not, you know, in the picture, and the lower rent, so it's affordable to someone who's trying to get their feet on the ground under them.
The affordability is key. For both the chronically homeless and people finding themselves without a steady home for the first time, the rental market in Anchorage is tough. Rent is on the rise, and Schultz says that's had a major impact on homelessness.
The rental business in any given U.S. city now is difficult to stay in. So if you're having a hard time with your finances, you might find yourself homeless simply because your lease ended, or perhaps the rents increased, and so you're just no longer able to stay where you were.
Schultz says he's heard many derogatory comments about the homeless in recent years, often containing blame or indifference. He doesn't see that as productive and is reassured by efforts made by the city, assembly, and community partners to stand up projects like the guest house.
We have to invert the thought that they can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, go out, get a job, clean themselves up from drugs or from trauma or for any number of things that are weighing them down. And then after all that, they can earn a house because by then they deserve it. It's got to go the other way. Everybody deserves it.
The purchase of the guest house was finalized on September 12th, and in the past 2 weeks, Schultz says everything has been running smoothly as people adjust to their new spaces. He hopes the guest house serves as an example for how to positively address homelessness.
My hope here is that people of Anchorage will look at this and say that this is productive, that it's cost effective, it saves money for the city in the long run, and most importantly, it's compassionate. It's just the right thing to do.
Schultz says many of the tenants of the guest house have opted for roommates, bringing the total number of people in new housing to approximately 200. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
After 3 years of negotiating, leaders of a pilots' union have approved a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines. The tentative agreement was announced Friday by the Airline Pilots Association International. Union leaders had said the existing contract was lacking compared to other airlines in several areas, including compensation, scheduling flexibility, and quality of life. The tentative agreement increases pay rates, retirement contributions, and compensation for flight reassignments. It also extends parental leave to both mothers and fathers and allows mothers to continue earning seniority during maternity leave. Members of the union will start voting on the agreement in the coming weeks. The union represents more than 3,100 Alaska Airlines pilots. Alaska Airlines customer service, cargo, and ground service workers ratified a 2-year contract last month. Every Delta Junction City Council seat on the municipal election ballot is being contested by two or more candidates. The city clerk says it's the most competitive election cycle she's seen in the 20 years she's been on the job. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Three city council seats are up for grabs this year, and unlike any city election over the past 20 years, each of the seats is contested, including one with three candidates.
And I'm impressed with that, with the number of people that have shown interest, yeah.
City Clerk Pat White has overseen municipal elections since she started the job 20 years ago, and she says last year's elections were more typical of those held in recent years. Only one person each signed up to run for one of the four open seats in 2021. So not surprisingly, that person won, and the other three seats were filled by write-in candidates, all winning by around 30 votes each.
We've always had someone fill a seat, but it's not a lot of interest until lately.
White says this year's election is different. She says she's never seen one in which all the seats are contested.
It's exciting. It's really exciting.
Exciting because it may be a signal that there's growing interest in local politics among Delta's 977 registered voters. That may be in part because of growing concerns over issues like funding emergency services, which the city council is now deliberating over. But White says she thinks candidates are more motivated by what's going on far outside of city limits.
I think a lot of it might have to do with what's happening on the national level. People are interested.
White suspects ongoing investigations into alleged wrongdoing by former President Trump has motivated at least some local candidates to step forward. And that includes those who consider themselves conservative and others who see things differently.
I've talked to the candidates, and I would say both.
White says ranked choice voting may also be a motivator, and also the usual conflict between Delta residents who don't want their small town to change and others who believe it's time to better manage a city government that provides services to the whole Deltana area.
You've got the ones that want to keep Delta the same, the way it's always been, and then there's the others that say there's no way we can support ourselves here.
White says she's hopeful that the number of candidates will translate into a higher turnout among voters. She can't predict how many, but she hopes it's more than the 74 voters who went to the polls last year. And she's encouraged that there's already been a couple of early ballots submitted.
Because there's a contest, I'm hoping that there's a better turnout. And I'm actually printing more ballots in preparation of that.
There's an even more contested seat on the local school board, with four candidates running for one seat and two incumbents seeking re-election to theirs. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Sacred Acre Electronic Dance Music Festival was held earlier this month at the Kenai Peninsula Fairgrounds in Ninilchik. According to organizers, it was the first festival of its kind in the state. KBBI's Desiree Hagen attended the festival and has this story.
The three-member electronic band Balkan Bump mixes loops and beats with trumpet, clarinet, and traditional Middle Eastern instruments like the stringed oud and an Armenian wind instrument called the duduk. Projected behind the group is a digital psychedelic backdrop of undulating colors synchronized to the melodies. This is the California-based group's first time in Alaska. That's also true for many of the acts playing at the first ever Sacred Acre Music Festival held in Inilchik in early September. Maz Karandish is a multi-instrumentalist with Balkan Bump.
I am all about bringing those sounds and the music of the East and the Near East in a way that is inviting and relatable to West Coast American festival culture, because I see it as a form of cultural preservation.
Balkan Bump is just one of over 20 acts that performed at the Sacred Acre Festival. The three-day event was held at the same location as the popular Salmon Fest Music Festival, which aims to promote salmon and the watersheds that sustain them. Sacred Acre has a similar conservation mission in mind, to advocate for healthy Alaska fisheries. Chris Miller is the festival's main organizer. He says once he has paid off the initial investments, future proceeds will be donated to bring attention to the effects of trawling bycatch in the Bering Sea. Wandering through the fairgrounds, I encounter Kelly Lyon. She's with Camp Unicorn, an intentional festival community that she founded with her partner, Kale Laces. The couple lives a mostly nomadic lifestyle, living and working remotely from a converted van. Lyon says Camp Unicorn was formed to create a safe space for festival goers, offering a community kitchen, bar, heaters, costumes, and an art space.
We host this space, but the community really brings it in and brings it together.
During our interview, her partner Laces walks up wearing a homemade faux fur Cruella de Vil Dalmatian jacket, but otherwise topless in neon reflective booty shorts. But while his costume is playful, his message is serious. One part of Camp Unicorn is providing test strips for the synthetic opioid fentanyl and distributing Narcan kits, which are used to counteract opioid overdoses in emergency situations.
So we partnered with a organization that distributes these from Project Hope, which is really working to help counteract the tide of fentanyl overdoses that we have going on.
Safety at the festival was a major concern to more than just the Camp Unicorn folks. Festival organizer Chris Miller says a full security team and medical staff was on site in case of emergency. Miller considers the festival a success. He says around 2,500 people, including vendors and volunteers, visited the campgrounds for the weekend. And over 300 of the ticket sales sold came from out of state.
We put an Inilchik on the map in the electronic world, and the electronic world has a lot of sway and a lot of people, and that's what we're doing here. We're here to stimulate the economy and help save the Bering Sea's ecosystem.
Miller says he's already looking forward to next year's festival. Reporting from the Kenai Peninsula Fairgrounds in Inilchik, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clinton, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Davis Hovey in Nome, Emily Schwing in Chivac, Will McCarthy in Hooper Bay, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Desiree Hagen in Inilchik. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.